So Hao told me that usually in this wonderful place, people introduce themselves somehow on Mondays. Sadly, it was a mistake, I'm sure. I wasn't here yesterday morning. So I have to introduce myself now. I have been working for an enormous long time now, more than 11 years at the National Center for Biotechnology Information at NIH in Bethesda, right across the street from the Naval Hospital, where all these helicopters with presidents and so on come. So we're basically these fat government rats who sit there and don't apply for any grants and just do stupid things on your, that is, the taxpayers' money. So the specific stupid thing that we try to do, we usually call it computational biology, to feel that we are of some importance, that basically that they are some kind of scientists. Whereas other people call it bioinformatics, because they don't want to consider us scientists. They want to think that we sit there to produce some software and databases to help the biological community. Well, I guess the reality, as it happens, is somewhere in between. While I'm not intent on giving you much of my biography, I think it's irrelevant, largely, but a little bit might be slightly relevant. Originally, I come from the former Soviet Union, from what is now Russia, and that will be reflected in the names of my collaborators. I'll start this discussion today from there, because what I want to, or what I decided to present here, at my own peril, I strongly suspect, the development of some fairly simple models that somehow approximate right into my eyes that somehow approximate genome evolution. Now we had this very interesting discussion yesterday during the lunch hour about the computability in biology, and there were many things, but the bottom line, as I got it, is that what the biologists are really interested in is, of course, not computable. It's a real wonderful complexity of life. But since physicists and mathematicians and whoever need to apply themselves somehow, they want to replace this life reality with something computable, which is hopelessly oversimplified, of course. And this is exactly the case of what is going on here. To give you the flavor of what is going on, I think I better start with an old and tired joke coming from the old country. That is why I said that it's somewhat relevant that I come from there. The joke goes something like that. Officers of the old Red Army, you know, the people from the old country recognize their names. This was usually about Vasily Ivanovich and Petka. But for the others, just two officers from the Red Army talk, and an older general and a younger officer who just came back from some Soviet equivalent of West Point after getting a good education. The commanding officer asks this young guy, "So, how did you spend the time? What did you learn?" "Oh, sir, I learned something enormously important. I learned the power of abstract thinking." "Huh, that's kind of interesting. So, could you demonstrate that power to me?" You see, I'm always puzzled by this question. Look at this train, look at the train outside the window. This train goes, has these round wheels and goes smoothly on the rail. And yet there is some strange rattling noise. Tuck, 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 tuck. Huh. It's nothing to crackle this abstract thinking. Just look at this train. What does it consist of? It consists of that stuff, you know, passengers or engineers, whatever, up there, all these wagons, all these, you know, chrome and glitter and paint, and the wheels. See, all that is up there, engine and all, this is not important. They abstract from that. So, think of wheels. What are these wheels? They're these, you know, steel discs that fit into the rails. They abstract from all of this. Let's say these, under abstract thinking, these wheels are circles. And what are circles? Circles are PR square. Now we abstract ourselves from PR, and we just think of this train as square going over these rails. Tuck, 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 tuck.
That was a topologist.
That guy, yes, he studied topology in the academy, apparently. The relevance of what I'm about to present to genome evolution will be pretty much like that. And the final point of introduction is this. I will show lots of equations here, which I hope at least I understand the meaning of, but he did not derive them. The person who derived all that and wrote all that is Georgi Kaev, who is right here. So whenever I say anything stupid, he'll bail me out. The way we started all this business was, following the fashion. The fashion nowadays is to see these kinds of power laws everywhere, where they belong, apparently, and otherwise. We were interested, basically, pretty much everything in biology is distributed, does not show anything like a Poisson or Gaussian distribution, but shows a power law distribution. If it's not, does not show a power distribution, it's not biology, basically. That's how it looks to me nowadays, especially when reading certain kinds of papers. And we decided that we were not worse than others. We should write some of those papers too. And we did. And we were interested to see specifically whether these power laws would somehow naturally come out of very, very naive, simple representation of genomes, pretty much as PR squared. And whether by doing so, if we manage to get through somehow, we will learn something about biology. Okay. In this audience, actually, I assume from the beginning that whatever equations they show, they will be completely understood and trivial. What might be not so trivial is what is a genome and how we view the genome. So I'll spend a couple of minutes trying to explain this. We consider the genomes, and the genome is the entire length of DNA representing the genetic material of a given organism. And in that genome, there are these pieces that encode proteins called genes. The rest are intergenic regions, and although they might comprise, say, in the human genome, together with introns that tend to interrupt these genes, these non-coding parts of the human genome comprise, say, 98.5%, we abstract from that. We will deal just with these pieces, which in a sense, of course, are indeed most important to determine the phenotype. The genes, however, are not such atomic units in the sense that Many proteins, especially in complex eukaryotic organisms, consists of two or more partly independent, at least individual entities, which we will call domains. Or they often correspond indeed to structural domains, although not necessarily. The main thing is that they tend to shuffle and recombine and behave with a degree of individuality and independence in the course of evolution. So, now, genes, of course, interact, and the order of genes, especially in prokaryotic simpler organisms such as bacteria and archaea, to some extent, also in the more complex organisms, the gene order are not random or not arbitrary, and the positioning of genes in genomes is important. They abstract from that. Yes?
Is there a correlation between domain structure and exon structure?
Let's call Wally Gilbert and ask. This is indeed a long story, an old question, as always in biology, the answer only can be yes and no. There is no straightforward correlation, but in certain classes of proteins, such as extracellular proteins, receptors, and so on, there is a considerable correlation, and intron shuffling does contribute to recombination and generation of diversity in eukaryotes, but this is not the only contribution.
But the recombination of domains is more frequent?
Partly mediated by intron shuffling, but exon shuffling, but not completely. The simple proof of what I said is that you have a considerable number of multi-domain proteins, even in prokaryotes, especially in more complex ones such as, say, actinomyces or streptomyces or something like that, or in very simple eukaryotic organisms such as yeast, which apparently lost almost all of their introns. Nevertheless, you have considerable amount of multi-domain proteins and significant domain shuffling. So such mechanism exists, but this is certainly not the only mechanism. However, lecture of the evolution of exon intron structure of genes is really a totally different lecture. I will be happy to deliver it next time. Oh, if people are interested, yes, I can do parts of that in the discussion. Oh, I even have slides, you know, if somebody is interested. Okay. So basically, here we do bean-bag genomics. We consider a genome as a finite bag of more or less independent, or not more or less, just independent domains. So, parenthetically, I would say that comparing the gene orders, say, in eukaryotes, you start seeing that as a rough approximation, this is not so stupid. The gene orders are very, very variable. All right. The important part, what the whole story is more or less about. Basically, the whole story is more or less about families of paralogs. The principal process, one of the few central processes in evolution is gene duplication. You know, there was this breakthrough book by Susumu Ohno back in 1970, Evolution by Gene Duplication, and when it came to fore for the first time. And now it's very, very clear that very much, if not most, of genome evolution and diversification occurs through duplication with subsequent divergence. And the resulting families of genes, or we will talk about families of domains, because a domain is a more general, a better candidate for a unit of duplication, a more general kind of unit. These families are called families of paralogs, and we For short, we'll call them domain families. All right. So as for any kind of model, to proceed with these gross oversimplifications, we need to introduce some elementary events. Let me just repeat this. This acronym that I'm using throughout means birth, death, innovation models. Those who come from the former Soviet Union will somehow appreciate the humoristic quality of this. okay. So this B, birth, corresponds to domain or gene duplication. Like this. We had three guys here comprising a family, and this one has been duplicated and produced a copy which was at moment time zero identical and then diverged.
But all the parallels in a given family are scattered throughout the genome, not spatially contiguous.
Oh, we don't care. They are, or in real life they are. Often there is also such an issue as tandem duplication. And there are islands of tandem duplications in the human genome. But for the purpose of this analysis, we don't care.
So these are genes or domains?
These are domains, but very often a gene corresponds to just one domain. Okay, the next process is this D, death. So there were two, but one has been lost. How it has been lost, by the way, it's an interesting issue. Yes, 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 go ahead.
Duplication is a perfect duplication.
As I said, yes. At time zero, when it happens, it's an identical copy. After that, of course, it drifts away. So death, elimination. How does this happen, you may ask? Actually, it may happen in different ways. It may happen by just, you know, physical excision, which deletion, which indeed does occur. Or it may happen by formation of pseudogene that sort of gradually fades away. It may also happen through rapid divergence where we don't recognize this as a paralog anymore. And finally, there is something that we call...
They're not tied together with birth. If the strand duplication occurs by recombination, then you add a piece of sequence to one strand and delete from the other. So what's born...
No. Wait. There is a little confusion here. What you describe may be called the transposition. Then a gene moves in the genome from one location to another. We don't care for that at all here. It's nothing for us. What matters for us is the only duplication, birth, and elimination, death. Say it again? Yes, this is a possibility.
A combination after replication, you'll get one strand long and one strand shorter.
Yeah, but the other, only one of those two is going to survive in the bacteria.
That's right. That's right. Well, there are all sorts of genome rearrangements, and of course it's possible that concomitantly with, say, duplication in this family, there will be death in this family, but not necessarily at all, let alone at this mechanistic level, there is no need at all for duplication in this family to be somehow linked to a death in that same family. At a totally different level, we will come to the discussion of such connections. Okay, so this I, finally, is this, innovation. and this is, of course, more controversial, more mysterious, if you wish. How can genes be born? Well, we know they are born. There are new genes that appear in genomes, apparently, there are, at least can think, or I know of, only three ways. One is just connected to this, then. Someone, a member of a family, can sort of tunnel through the barriers separating families and become something completely new operationally. This happens in evolution when the function dramatically changes. Now, the second possibility is to acquire something by the horizontal transfer, a subject that most of you have heard about probably, which has become even, you know, a matter of fairly acrimonious debate with regard to the extent and timing of such events in eukaryotic evolution, and whether, you know, the human genome has acquired any genes from bacteria and such issues. We don't have to discuss this in any detail now. For us, it's just useful to remember, we'll come back to that a little bit, that whoever says what, this happens, and this happens very often in the prokaryotic world among bacteria and archaea. It also definitely happened early in eukaryotic evolution. Whether it happened later in eukaryotic evolution is still an open issue, which is of great interest, but not for today's discussion. All right. And the third way for the third path to innovation might be origin of domains, of protein domains, from basically nothing, from non-coding sequences. Perhaps the most controversial subject, because we don't know many examples of this, and yet I do suspect that this happened. At least that's something that, again, early in eukaryotic evolution probably took place. All right? So we have introduced these elementary events. Yes?
What about fusion of parts of two different domains to make a new type of domain? Does that happen
right now? In a sense, it does not happen by definition. Because, as I said, a domain is something that has an individuality, a unique fate in evolution, and which most often, if not always, corresponds to unique structural features. So it's extremely difficult to cut that thing in two or more and do some recombination and produce something viable. It happens probably in evolution, but very, very infrequently. Recombination of domains themselves, shuffling of domains to form multi-domain proteins, is a whole different matter. It happens quite often, and this is exactly the reason why we prefer to. There is an operational reason for that, to which I will come, but more conceptually, this is the reason why we prefer to talk about domain families rather than just gene families. Okay, so finally we come to PER squared, and these circles represent domain families, and these such clusters of circles represent size classes of domain families. So this is basically class 1. That is the compendium of all families that consist of only one members. So what might happen to this class 1? Well, basically, three kinds of things. One is you may die. Yes, I mean, the domain family may die at a certain rate, which we'll designate delta, in this case, delta sub 1, which is the rate of death of families in this class. You may also be luckier than that and undergo a duplication. Or as a result of that duplication, move to this class 2.
So, sorry, yes.
Yes.
So in one case you have this four. What do the four symbols indicate? The four circles indicate in the first case, and what would the three squares indicate in the second case?
Oh, squares? Oh, okay, yeah. Call them squares.
Yeah.
That's okay. Okay. These squares represent families that consist of exactly one member. These squares represent families that consist.
Yeah, I don't. All of them duplicated.
I'm sorry.
Why each family? Why all the families duplicated at the same time?
Where did you get that from? Where did you get that from?
Looking at the pictures.
Oh, okay, so the pictures maybe, I'm sorry then, I don't, that's the pictures could be sometimes extremely misleading. Now, no one duplicated at the same time. They just completely, maybe they should have been colored in different colors or something. They are completely independent little squares that just consist only one member, and that's all. That's all they need. Why show three here, or four here, three here, and just one here in these high classes? That's because the distribution is roughly like that, and that there are more of these than any of these, and so on and so forth, as we shall see. And I just roughly represent it.
But your model simplifies so that the base rate for every single member family is the same. The total one is the same number for every single member family.
Oh, now that is true. That is true. Well, we'll discuss the dependence or lack thereof of these rates on the family size. That will be part of this. Or that actually is one of the principal components of the whole game. In the simplest case, of course, it does not depend. For each of these little guys in this large family, according to these models, the rates of duplication or elimination are the same. That is absolutely so. Yes?
So this whole line of squares represents the genome, which contains single member families, N1 single, or maybe D1 single number families, D2 double member families, etc.
That's perfectly true.
And these little arrows are acting independently on circles and not on families.
Oh, this last phrase, I don't quite understand.
Take a single
maybe the equations will be more clear once you show us the equations.
Yeah, it should be clear from the equations, but it should be clear also from here. This lambda 1 is just the rate of duplication in families of class 1. So this guy and this guy and this guy had the same probability to undergo duplication in a certain time interval, they're completely, in that respect, completely independent from each other. This guy may duplicate, this guy may die, and they don't know about each other. They don't. Moreover, and more. So let me just jump ahead of myself a little and say that under the models that we will discuss today, or perhaps not under the models that will be developed tomorrow, but under the models we will discuss today, they will never know anything of each other. These little specks here within the squares, however, at some point will gain certain knowledge of each other. Yes.
So in this model, there's no effect of a link. A long domain is just as likely to be duplicated as a short domain.
That is so. That is so. It's domain is atomic.
Right.
Here.
Is that a good approximation to long and short domains?
I would say yes. This is a fairly good approximation. Because really what we are looking at is not the duplication that happened in the genome. Anything can duplicate. But at those that are preserved, fixed, kept by evolution. And in that respect, a domain is a unit, so it makes sense.
And there are no genes in the story. There are no genes in the story. We're not worrying about duplicating domains and shuffling domains.
No, we are not worried about that. Okay. So this is how it happens in this very oversimplified fashion. Yeah, okay. I should have done this animation while I talk. It could be even a little clearer, but we are through that anyhow. I forgot it was there simply. So the equations are here we'll look at the elementary basic equation for just one family of size I. And after all that has been said, I guess, there is no special reason to discuss this at all. These numbers should be quite clear. If we go to the whole system of these equations from family size 1 to family size n, we get something like this, and I suppose this is quite obvious. Basically, a family of size I is born if there is a duplication in class I minus 1, and if it dies, there is one less, and if it itself duplicates, it moves to the next class, so there is one less here, and finally, if one dies in the next class, someone falls here. Quite obvious. Say it again, please.
Is it clear that continuous evolution with differential equation is a good approximation to discrete events?
It's it's a good. It's a good question, of course. I guess, you see, it depends on the scale, I suppose, of how we consider that, but what's the alternative, if you wish? Yes?
Where did you get the maximum from?
The maximum is rather an artificial contraption that allows one to construct these models. It does not, it actually has been shown that this value does not affect anything much here. So you may just say that this is, say, the maximum, some high number. Take it with some extra. Consider it the size of the genes in the the size of the complete number of domains encoded in the genome, or twice the complete number of domains encoded in the genome, something of that sort. Looking at this, of course, you also see this notorious term new, which is innovation. So the way innovation happens, basically, something comes into class 1. The convention here is that in this kind of innovation contributes only to this first class. That is, you do not, it's not allowed for a new family to be born in the, with a large number of members immediately. that is, you have to get one by one way, in one way or another, and then you evolve it and duplicate, and it moves towards other classes. And of course, this maximum class can only basically die.
Why can't you keep on making new?
You see, you cannot go on. There is some limit. You can, we don't quite know it. But this is used more as a convention. But you cannot grow your genome infinitely. What do you mean? Why? I don't think it's possible. Or I don't think that there are creatures on Earth with a million genes. There are simply none. And you can use that number, and you can have n equal to million if you like. It does not really matter. There are creatures like humans with 30,000 genes. There may be very well other creatures that don't look as spectacular as humans, but nevertheless have 100,000 genes. I can bet you anything, there are no creatures with 1 million genes. No, as I said, it does not. That has been explored, and things change very little if you change this n by an order of magnitude. You can very well put n equal to 1 million and be happy. Yes?
I'm a little bit confused about how you count number of domains. Suppose one domain is 1.0,
that means the value. No, even if they're identical. Even if they're identical, that's two. If there are two copies of DNA that encode domains of this family, and as I said, and then duplication happens at time zero, there are two identical copies, and they count as two, not one. They need not to be different. They just need to exist there in the genome. In that sense, we are somewhat realistic, if you wish. They are there, encoded in the genome. We count them as two.
Your innovation, one of your innovation processes is one kind going to another, which is not two.
It's effectively here. It's just that in that case, in that case, innovation is connected to death. Okay. It's just the total number of families for completeness. So basically, I already see that we will not have a chance to discuss everything that I wanted to discuss. But the first part of what I wanted to discuss are completely deterministic models that are open at one end, where you can get from sort of nowhere these class 1 families. Now, the important part, of course, of this whole business is whether these models can reach equilibrium. In a sense, it's a requirement, because we sit here and talk about this, we have been here for a long time, many millions of years. So any realistic model should reach equilibrium in which we apparently exist. Otherwise, we would lose our genes or just develop some genome cancer or something like that. And we'll see conditions under which one indeed develops something like that. Of course, the equilibrium conditions can be written in this obvious way, or strong equilibrium, if you wish, or number of domain families in each size class, the weak condition again, for the total number of domains. And it can be shown indeed that these models arrive to unique and stable equilibrium state with these frequencies, and this is reached exponentially with respect to time. For the total number of domains, you can describe this equilibrium in a most simple form simply by writing down that the innovation rate, which again contributes only to class 1 as we discussed, is equal to the rate of death of families of this class. So, the simplest of these models goes like this, which we call, which we just call simple birth, death, and innovation model, is based on the assumption of independence. That is, all elementary events, I promised in the beginning to discuss the relationship between genes in a family, and this is what we do. Under the simplest model, all elementary events are independent of each other. That is, the rates of birth and death of individual domains do not depend on the number of domains in a family, and accordingly, for a family of size I, the total rate of death or birth is simply proportional to the number of domains in this family, and accordingly, the basic equation for the evolution of such a domain family can be written in this simple form. In more graphic terms, happens? The general equilibrium solution will be a truncated logarithmic distribution. Under this very specific condition that the rate of death is equal to the rate of birth, we arrive to a very specific form of the famous power law with a degree of minus 1, just like this in double logarithmic coordinates.
Where lambda I and delta I defined to the lower number of the pair?
I'm sorry?
So lambda I and delta I, the pair of arrows going back between two families, index I in both cases? Because it makes... it seems that that's where the total flux is proportional to the number of families or the number of...
The total rate of birth or death, the probability that in a given time interval, a domain of family of size 100 will be duplicated is, let's say, 100. For the domain of family 1, the probability that a domain of class 1 will be duplicated during that same time is, say, 1. If, however, normalized by the family size, it's the same. And that is the essence of these simple models. These members of families know nothing of each other. Anything to add, Georgi?
Yes,
as I said, this is the essence of the simplest model. In a few moments, we'll see how they start gaining some knowledge of each other.
Simple model is linear or is constant?
Lambda
I or just lambda?
Okay. As I said, the probability per domain of being born or dying is constant. The probability of doing that per family is linear. Oh, family size,
okay.
Number of members. All right. So one can, to be somewhat theoretical in general, one can classify these models in the following way. Basically, what we call master of beam is just, you know, any function of the any kind of function of the number of members in such a family, and then we go to what may be called rational models, and the subclass of these are polynomial models, and this in the real world, what we can explore reduces more or less to these kind of models, which depend in different or increasingly complex ways on the number of members in a family. We'll, in the rest of what I have to say, we'll largely examine these linear and quadratic models. So basically, you can also write down this balance condition for a family. Or in a form of this kind of, you can do it in many different ways, of course, but you, basically Georgi has done that in the form of this kind of expansion. So this is basically the number, rate of birth in the family of size I minus 1, that is the flux of domains into family under analysis, and this is the death rate, that is the flux of domains out of this family. And you can write it down in this ways and classify these models with respect to balance by looking at these different parameters. So if this parameter is not zero, is non-zero, what we get are what I will call non-balanced models. Such models are real bad because either die out or expand uncontrollably. Now, if this parameter is equal to zero, you get into the class of balanced models. Balanced models also can have different order. So, if this parameter is anything other than 1, you have this first order balanced model, and if it's equal to 1 here, you have, or depending on this other parameter, either what is called second order balanced model, which is something that we will explore in a moment, or and then you have some kind of non-trivial distribution of the number of these families, or you have this higher order model, and in this case, you have a totally uninteresting distribution of the numbers of these models of these families. That is the same number of family of each class. So just to summarize this, we will not be interested in non-balanced models because this is basically they all either fall into either very small or very large families, and we will not be interested in high order balanced models, or because this results in a uniform distribution. And what we will now discuss is the linear. Before we proceed to empirical, to comparing this to the empirical data, I'll just show the features of the linear model.
Sorry,
yes.
Why would be this residual rate lambda independent of I of the number of numbers? That's not included at all.
Okay. Wait. The features,
What would there be a lambda A term in the lambda I? So what would be the mechanistic interpretation of that?
That I don't know. What's the mechanistic interpretation of those terms. I'll speculate on that issue a little bit.
So
but
now it's just fitting parameters.
Yeah, they are just fitting different kinds of. This is so far per simple theory. It just can behave as I said. You know, you look at this master dream. It can be any function. It can be anything you like. It just you'll see in a moment that we need to get at least that complicated. That we cannot get away with a simple model there without no dependence, even if you like. For the moment, we'll get away with this.
Maybe
yes.
Rather than thinking about it, the right way to think about it is if A, for example, is 0 and B is 0, this is a model in which all the units are behaving completely independently.
But that's the way to think about it. That's what it is.
So think of a non-zero value of A or B, think of it as a perturbation. Of the original model that, for example, might reflect the fact that there's some evolutionary disadvantage having your genome filled with many duplicates of a single.
Well, this is exactly what it is. This is exactly right. This is just exactly right. I would like to say, and I'll try. To say something a little bit more concrete, but really not by far. Basically, we had this solution for the equilibrium frequencies for this linear model, which takes some space, but actually is very simple. And for large I, this can be approximated by in this fashion. This model will come if this ratio equals to 1. This model will come to a power asymptote with large I, where the slope is this. Didn't fit here just a little bit. A minus B minus 1. And at this point, I'll switch from this purely mathematical presentation to something approaching reality. This is just switch to a different mode for a moment. And let's just look at the real genomes, say, of a variety of organisms which we explore, but say, let's take a plant and human and E. coli bacterial genome, or more precisely, not a genome, but the set of protein domains encoded in these genomes. So basically, what we need to do is to count those beads, all of these kinds of beads. To do so, what we undertake is taking the so-called CDD collection of position-specific scoring matrices. So CDD stands for a conserved domain database, which has been developed at the NCBI a couple of years ago and is being updated constantly. But at some point, you basically take a certain version of this collection, which consists of the position-specific scoring matrices. For those who know what that is, it's very, very clear. For those who don't, these are sort of descriptors of domains which you can use computationally to recognize. Basically, if you get a, you take this thing and you apply a program which is called reverse PSI blast, reverse position-specific iterating blast. Using that program, you sort of throw these profiles onto the sets of proteins encoded in each genome, and you get certain hits, certain e-values. Yes.
These CDPs are the gap-less-aligned domains.
I'm sorry.
Are these CDP profiles derived from the line of gap-less alignment?
There's something that you're saying that escapes me. Derived from what?
Gapless alignment.
No.
Gaps. So in your position-specific profile, there are scores for gaps.
There are scores for gaps. This is really a totally, totally different subject. But just suffice it to say that you are familiar at all with the PSI blast problem method. This is done in the same fashion. Okay. There is statistics for this kind of analysis, and you get e-values. So of course you set a certain cutoff, which is in a sense a relatively conservative cutoff of 10 to the minus 3, and you register all such hits. So basically, just to speak about it somewhat conceptually, you take the recognizers, the descriptors, for all known domains, hoping, not without reason, that this is the majority of domains that exist in the world. These are, to be slightly more precise on that, these are more or less all widely represented domains. Of course, there are some very unique, very rare ones which are not here, but all widely represented ones are here. And this is a fairly sensitive method for detecting them. So, very hopefully, we are detecting the majority of instances of each of these domains in each of the that are encoded in each of these genomes. So basically, you count them all, and if a domain is very common, you may have 100 hits better than that, and if the domain is rare, you can have one hit better than this. Of course, if it's very rare, you get zero hits in a particular genome. So you can finally produce that kind of distribution of domain family sizes empirically from real data and compare that to what we have done. So basically, you have to fit the curve produced by each of these models to what is really observed. Now, if you look at this, just at these points, you see immediately that this deviates from the straightforward power law very significantly at this end. And then something peculiar happens in this end, because there is a whole lot of this scatter of the rare domains. So essentially, you need to carefully fit the data to the the number of domains, of course. It's a double logarithmic scale, the number of domains in a family, number of the of such families accordingly. So evidently, it's going more or less like a power law. That is, you have the greatest number of domains of families with just one member and two, and so on and so forth. For example, I don't remember. We'll look at very specific ones which are labeled, but that'd be for coli, cumin, whatever you like. Or of course, you can get something very similar if you combine them. But in reality, we usually don't.
So So just to sort of fix the numbers, so how many BSSMs do you start with?
A few thousand, but I cannot give you the very exact number. On the order of about 4,000.
Okay. And then in the human genome, how many hits would there be for this particular E value? For all of them added together, what's the sum of the total number of domains?
We'll actually come to the exact numbers. But just to be clear about that, what we hit is something between one half and two thirds of all proteins that are there. The speaking of coverage, this is about the coverage there is. Okay. So finally, you know, we come to the trick, to the actual issue, to see how these different. Okay, and the more important number, of course, doesn't fit the screen. That's normal. We try to approximate the actual distributions with different kinds of models. And what we see is that while it may not immediately look enormously impressive to you, what we see, however, is we can rule out the simple model as a good description. This is 6 that you may not see here. We can rule out the straightforward power law distribution even more convincingly. But the linear model, okay, lovely. Linear model, and let me just be clear about that, is the simplest thing, the simplest kind of model that under these circumstances we cannot discard, that seems to describe the data. And here is, speaking of E. coli, here are these distributions indeed for E. coli and these different approximations.
Sorry, I didn't get how you actually do the statistics. So for the linear model, you have like 5 different parameters, right?
No, why? Only 2.
You have base, birth, and a linear additive term, A and B, and then there's the innovation parameter. So total, there are 5 parameters in your model.
Not really. The only thing that we change here are the parameters A and B. There are only 2 parameters that we change to fit the data.
There is also overall proportionality constant for the linear.
Say it again?
For the linear function, there is also proportionality constant.
Proportionality
constant? No, that's not my point. My point is that, so how did you actually do statistics? You actually change your first optimize, get the best fit within the parameter family. And then, then you do what, chi-square test or something like that?
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, I see.
Indeed, we do chi-square test. They optimize these A and B parameters, and we'll see what they equal to. And we do a chi-square test.
Can you explain what I didn't understand? Different points correspond to what? Different species?
Here?
Yeah.
No. Lord forbid. Correspond, it's just one species, and they correspond to different family size clusters. So we have a certain number of families with just one member, a certain number of families with 2 members, and so on and so forth. Is that not clear? We have families with one member, and we have many of these, and we have families with 2 members, and we have smaller number of these, and so on and so forth. It's just a family size distribution and nothing else for just one genome. In this case, for example, or the plant Arabidopsis.
Little bumps, which obviously wouldn't arise.
Yeah. Yeah, the trick that I don't touch upon here is that there are the distribution is sparse here. There may be no families of size 101 and a couple of families might understood anyhow. So you put them in little bins and then you get these little bumps. So the point they're making here is that indeed you can approximate this more or less, or the linear model, you cannot really approximate this with the simple model. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Chi-square value changes by a certain amount.
Yes.
And goes closer to zero.
Right.
It seems to be a problem. It seems to change by order of magnitude. And that's because it's a very high order chi-square system. Is that why it's happening?
So I suppose. Too many large families or too many small families for this particular kind of model. So basically, coming back to the famous power laws, I just illustrate here how the straight power law will go, like this red line here, in contrast, this green line here, dotted line, here is the description of the data, this linear dim. The power law approximation, the power law asymptotic for this kind of model. So basically, speaking of power laws, this is really quite a good description, power law with a certain slope, not minus one, but this kind of slope, depending on these parameters. A good description for large families, but not good at all, for small families. Basically, once again, this is about the simplest model that you can use to describe this kind of data. It's a long table that I'm not going to go through entirely, there are certain important numbers. One kind of numbers that I just want to mention, because there was a question on that account, and it's indeed of some importance, is that this is the number of proteins encoded in each of these genomes. The first five here are eukaryotic genomes, and probably most people can recognize the abbreviations, and the last five are prokaryotic genomes, and probably most people can't accept this, but it does not really matter. What matters is that they are small prokaryotic genomes, and this is the number of proteins. Of course, it's much larger in these eukaryotes, and this is the coverage, the number of hits with these domain profiles, something between, as I say, except for humans, where you have a pretty poor coverage, in fact, probably because many of these genes are not quite real genes. Most of the time, you have coverage between 50 and 60% or something like this. And this here.
You're defining coverage as being at least one hit.
Exactly. Exactly.
Matrix might just hit a portion of the protein. So if you took it as a hit rate, per sort of total fraction of the nucleotide length.
Nucleotide length is just hopeless because you mean in the entire genome?
No, that's just
coding nucleotides.
And then said, What fraction of them is covered by the...
I'm sorry to... evidently, it's less than this. This is upper bound. I mean, this, if you divide this by this, this will give you an upper bound.
Most human proteins, at least, are not single domain.
They may debate that proposition. That may not be quite true. Many human proteins are not single domains, and evidently when you do this kind of analysis, not all proteins are covered, because many human proteins have non-global regions and whatnot. So unfortunately, I don't give the number, don't have those numbers. As I say, if you divide this by this, you will obviously get the upper bound, and the real number, that number you're interested in is less, just how much less, I cannot say. Just. Well, I clearly cannot even think about finishing what I had to say. So under the realistic conditions, I'll just come to, I have a natural point of stopping in the middle. So I'll just come to that in 5 minutes. We may have a little bit in the discussion, but to that natural point of stopping, I will come in 5 minutes. okay. And here we have the number of domains in the first class as really seen and as predicted by this linear model. So this is quite a good correspondence. And these parameters, we don't really know what they mean, but here they are. But what is curious is the slope of the power law asymptotic, which goes somewhere between minus 2 and minus 3 on almost all occasions. And another thing that is quite interesting and somewhat unexpected to was the high rate of innovation which is produced by these models. This ratio of nu to lambda or to delta, which are of course about the same thing, this ratio is actually very, very high for all studied genomes. Quite startling at first, but what we must remember is that this lambda and this delta are actually the rates of death or birth per domain. So if we are scared by this and calculate these numbers for the entire rate of birth and death per genome, then these numbers are close to each other, which is still pretty startling in the sense that there is apparent, if we are to accept this kind of modeling, there is a whole lot of innovation going in the genome. And so finally, for this kind of linear models, I'll show the dependence of the per domain birth rate and death rate on the family size. So both of these decrease with the family size. In a sense, these models suggest this form of this of the BDIM suggests that families become sort of more stable as the number of members grows. That is, it's somewhat less likely to die and somewhat less likely to give birth, where the ratio tends to 1. Okay, and here is my relatively natural point of stopping, which is in reality is only in the middle of what I would like to say altogether. But here it is. Basically, I think I don't have to read this slide The conclusions are that apparently, I'll just talk for a moment about it. So the conclusions are that some playing with these simple models, we apparently can, under the completely deterministic setting, let me just repeat this, we apparently can adequately describe the empirically observed distributions of the domain or protein family sizes in the genomes using a certain quite simple evolutionary model. However, it cannot be as simple as to deny any kind of dependence of the rates of these processes on the existing family size. The simplest they can get away with under this setting is this linear second order balanced model. Apparently this suggests that larger families could be somewhat less evolutionarily dynamic. And finally, we see that the rates of domain innovation and birth are somewhat unexpectedly rather comparable. Generally, one would expect that the birth, that is, duplication rate, is greater, significantly greater than the innovation rate. So the second part of my talk, which I clearly have no opportunity to present, would proceed to stochastic Markov models, which would explore the following question. We have seen that we can approximate these equilibrium distributions. Let's now see, in realistic time that has been allotted by the evolution of the universe for the evolution of these genomes, can we or can we not reach the observed family size distributions, or let's say the family sizes as large as we see them under these models? I would just say that the conclusion would be that for this purpose, to produce a realistic picture of genome evolution in time, the linear model will be insufficient and we will have to postulate stronger interactions between the domains in a family and go at least to a quadratic models. And with this I will stop now, but just not one thing, that there is one thing that I do need to do yet. And that is to acknowledge my collaborators, Georgi Karev, who really came up with this formulation and did most, more or less all the mathematics. Yuri Wolf, who was mostly involved in data fitting, the setting up the domain, PSS and searches and statistics on that and so on. And of course, we all together, you know, consider the application, the implications, and I was speculating on the biology of this, and Andrei Rzhetsky and Faina Berezovskaya, who helped us with both with the ideas and the mathematics. And thank you very much.